The Iowa Art Showcase is Iowa Public Radio's monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. As we celebrate our sixth year of IPR's Iowa Art Showcase, for September, we'll chat with the principal violinist of the St. Martin in the Fields Chamber Ensemble about their upcoming tour. We'll talk with the explorer who discovered new poetry by James Hurst. We'll hear about one of our state's early movers and shakers and the role he played in broadcasting. We'll quiz the Whitney Museum of American Art curator as she shares insight into a new 2018 exhibit featuring works by Iowa's most celebrated artists. And we'll see how the Waterloo Center for the Arts plans to roll out the red carpet for this year's Haitian Art Society's annual conference. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Thanks for joining us. The hosting architects of this year's Haitian Art Society's annual conference is being presented by a museum in Iowa that has an outstanding collection. The Waterloo Center for the Arts, with Executive Director Kent Schenkel, along with Curator Sean Page, are assembling a magnificent series of events. This year's symposium kicks off with an incredible lineup of Haitian exhibits, visiting artists, lecturers, authors, private collection tours, and hobnobbing in the Cedar Valley. This portion is followed by an unbelievable museum road trip to see amazing Haitian art collections in Dubuque, Milwaukee, Chicago, and Davenport. Kent and Sean share details on the conference and the magic captured in Haitian art.
People might be surprised by the level of interest and the reaction that people from outside our community have when they visit Waterloo for conferences like these.
I think how the Waterloo Center for the Arts is presenting the works and presenting their collection, we have kind of created contexts to understand the work. So it's not just a survey of all of our collection, but each of the exhibitions that we've put together are kind of focused into not only individual artists and styles and mediums, but there's stories to be kind of experienced, to kind of get a deeper appreciation of Haitian culture and deeper appreciation of the individual artists that we're kind of representing. And I mean, ultimately, we would hope that as stewards of this collection, that we're kind of moving the bar forward and moving the understanding of Haitian culture in the right direction. I think the works that we have with Gerard's exhibit, as well as Pascal Monin's exhibit, from one perspective, you have like the traditional art forms, and then you have like what's happening contemporary, what's happening right now. So these are pieces that are post-earthquake and post-hurricane that are coming out, and they're rich and lush and beautiful.
And I would hope that the community, whether they have any existing interest in Haitian art or culture or Caribbean art or culture or not, would maybe recognize that we do have a world-class collection here. It's a resource for them. And this is a great time, even if they've never thought about checking it out, to do that, because they will be surrounded by people who are passionate about it and who are knowledgeable about it and who have been willing to travel across the country to see it and experience it and be able to experience it on many, many levels. Certainly, anyone can come anytime and see a portion of the works on display, but at this time, they'll be strewn throughout the museum. You'll get to see many things that normally would be locked up in the vault, and you'll also be able to hear many perspectives on them from people who are very much entrenched in Haitian culture, who are knowledgeable about the history, who are knowledgeable about the religion, things that you wouldn't be able to pick up in a casual visit to the museum. You'll be able to sample foods that represent the culture as well. So you'll be able to spend a weekend steeped in the culture. And if you're that interested and committed, you can get on the bus and travel with us to visit some of the other really significant Haitian art collections. And so I think those who participate in the conference will really be able to come away with a very deep and at least an enhanced understanding and appreciation, and hopefully will spark their interest in Haitian art further.
Executive Director Kent Schenkel, along with the curator Sean Page of the Waterloo Center for the Arts. One of the most prominent stars of Haitian art, Edouard Duval Carrier, is also one of the distinguished artists on the conference's guest list. His work, Endless Flight, dating from 2000, plus a new Figge Museum commission, will be part of the Haitian conference tour at the Figge in Davenport. In fact, the Davenport Art Museum was the first purchaser of one of Duval Carrier's works.
It's incredible. I'm still, you know, like puzzled and wondrous about this connection, which I really appreciate. And this is a friendship that goes back as far as 30 or 40 years now. And when I did my first exhibit, a whole contingent of the museum from Davenport was in Haiti. And the director of that museum, Larry Hoffman, then, he passed away, was there. And he said, we have to get this piece for our museum. I said, well, wonderful. It was the first piece I've ever sold in my life. So, and it's been a friendship based on respect. And it's been wonderful. Many years back, they came and they said, well, it's time for you to make a major piece for us. So this is what is going to be presented at the Figge very soon. So I'm very happy. It's a massive installation that I took a year or two to build. And to see it again would be a delight for me. So I'm looking forward to that very much.
I've heard that with the amount of money that you got for this first work of art, you purchased a pickup with it.
An international harvester, which was already a dinosaur when I bought it. I enjoyed it very much. I had it for years, I mean, at least a decade, that car. But that story still goes on, my international harvester that I bought with the sale of a big painting. So I was delighted. I've always thought it was very, very touching, the whole thing.
How has the Midwest and the collectors in the Midwest affected your career?
To have a first sale and for it to go to a museum certainly gave me some degree of confidence in what I was doing. I've always considered that this was a very interesting debut for me. So it put me on the right track. I mean, maybe I could have gone off to school to study something else. But, you know, I mean, I've been always very touched by these moments that I've had and that there's an interest in bringing back my work, giving me credibility up to a certain point. And something that I hold dear to my heart, you know, I mean, until I drop. And now I have another interest in the Midwest. I'm going to do a project with Grinnell, and that particular school is very interesting to me because, I mean, it was part of the Underground Railroad and was the first one to accept women and blacks in their midst. I mean, this is more than a century ago, if not more. So, I mean, to me, that's very interesting history that exists in the Midwest, that is not as well known as it should be, because I think that's very interesting and very touching also that this core part of the United States has had very progressive ideas since the beginning. So to me, that's very important to make people realize that, that region has always had individuals in it that were very progressive and big humanists, that they believed in life, they believed in all people and how to integrate all sorts of things together. And that's, to me, you know, like a very important lesson. And I will try to do something with that to make sure that I do something interesting about that, to make it more well-known. Because every time I go, I said, what's the history? And that's the first thing they tell you. And I said, why isn't this household story that people tell to each other? So I find it that one can talk about things in a positive way rather than just have preconceived ideas or prejudices that are false.
I had heard that you were going to do sort of a gallery collection of different kinds of works using objects from the Grinnell collection.
That's exactly what I will be doing as well. I have a professor that is working with me on that, and we're starting with my own collection. You know, the life of pieces. Every document man makes has a history and carries a lot. And by looking at certain things and making juxtapositions and presenting it in a different format might bring people to look at them a little bit differently or deeper than just an object. And we have collections and collections at Grinnell, which are fabulous. I mean, they have scientific objects, they have like art, they have scientific models. I mean, all of these things are going to be part of the exhibit. Because every object, everything has a story. And sometimes the story is a little bit more complicated than the face value of the object itself.
Now, you told us a bit about your Endless Flight installation at the Figge Art Museum, but you're also going to be having a new painting there, which is 12 feet long and kind of has colonialism along with the exotic in it. Tell us about that work.
I did an exhibit recently on landscapes. And after the effects of the Monroe Doctrine plays all over the Americas with the nascent United States and a powerful one, they were trying to, you know, like, first of all, liberate the rest of South America. And, of course, they were trying to stop the business with Europe. And people down there said, well, we've had business with them. I mean, you're not bringing anything to the table. So what they did was to send a battery of artists. The most famous ones were the groups that went down from the Hudson School of painters, which, you know, like, really did an inventory of these areas, you know, like to present to potential investors in the North, in Chicago and New York. And the type of work that they did was very telling. They recreated, they turned it into like this Eden-like looking kind of rediscovering something that had been lost, you know. I mean, they were quite enchanting paintings. So what I did was to take each one of them, and there's a few of them very famous, like The River of Light by Frederick Church, which I redid in a much larger format, even though these were big, but at night this time. And the whole exhibit was painted, you know, like presenting the time during a day, you know, like which where the sun is going down and it's very dark and it's after a rain, so everything is like sparkling. So I painted them literally with glitter glue to give that effect. And it was quite successful, I think. It really created some magical landscape at this point.
Haitian artist Edouard Duval-Carrier. Duval-Carrier is one of the Haitian Art Society annual conference's guest artists. To hear more from Edouard Duval-Carrier, Ken Chankel, and Sean Page, please check out IPR's Iowa Art Showcase website from our Iowa Public Radio homepage. The Waterloo Center for the Arts is hosting the 2017 Haitian Art Society's conference on September 23rd through the 28th. If you'd like to be part of the conference, the museum tour, or both, please contact the Waterloo Center for the Arts at 319-291-4490 or see their website at waterloocenterforthearts.org. Just ahead, we'll get the inside scoop on newly discovered poetry being featured at the Cedar Falls Author Festival. We'll bask in the glow of radio tubes as we hear about one of Iowa's early broadcasting movers and shakers. We'll remember one of Iowa's most famous artists, and we'll hear details about an outstanding chamber ensemble concert featuring world-class performers. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. The renowned Academy of St. Martin in the Fields Chamber Ensemble celebrates their 50th anniversary this year by going on an American tour. Fortunately for us in Iowa, we're part of their whirlwind circuit when they appear at UNI's Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. We caught up with their principal first violinist, Harvey D'Souza, and he shared a bit of background history on how the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields got started.
Academy was formally started in 1959 by Sir Neville Mariner, who at that time was playing principal second violin in the London Symphony Orchestra. And to put it into context, at that time there was a penchant to do huge things, you know, to play, for example, Handel's Messiah with an orchestra three times the size of a symphony orchestra, four choruses, and everything was a big event and done such a way. And I think Neville felt that he wanted to get back to the roots of particularly Baroque music was about. That's how it started. And he got a bunch of his friends, and they would rehearse in his living room. And then I think the harpsichordist at the time that they were playing with them was also the harpsichordist at the St. Martin's Church on Trafalgar Square. And Neville said, you know, I could put on a couple of concerts. Why don't we try that? And they did. And it so happens, I believe, that one record producer, I think it was Argo, the label managing director of this recording company, happened to come to this concert. And these people are really good, you know. And I think shortly after, they were signed up to recording contracts, and they went on to them, started touring a lot. And that was basically the foundation of it. And then the chamber ensemble, that grew out of the players themselves thinking, well, look, if we are going to do all of this repertoire, why not explore also chamber music that was not specifically just string quartets? Because, you know, there were plenty of string quartets around, but, you know, exploring quintets, sextets, trios, all kinds of septets, octets that were slightly larger. And that's how it started. And then, of course, then it sort of slowly evolved as the front desk player. So basically what the chamber ensemble of the Academy is all the front desk players of the string section. And, of course, when we do wind, the principal winds of the orchestra. So it allows musicians to explore the extraordinary world of chamber music. It's really a positive thing.
And both the chamber ensemble and the big Academy have made many, many recordings.
Yes, I believe we are the most recorded chamber orchestra on this planet. So I think that we've 600-700 CDs or something they've made, recordings. But nowadays, unfortunately, there aren't that many recordings happening. The world has changed tremendously in that respect. When I first joined the Academy in the early 90s, we were doing a recording a month. Now we probably do maybe a couple a year.
Tell us about this tour that you're on in the United States.
It's a fabulous tour. I mean, it takes us to extraordinary places. I mean, I think one of the places we're going to is Kalamazoo, and I don't think I've ever been to Kalamazoo, so I'm really excited about that. And actually, I'll tell you a little interesting anecdote. I went to college in Philadelphia. I lived in Philadelphia for 10 years, and I worked in the chamber orchestra. And in all the 10 years that I lived in America, after joining the Academy in 2 years, I saw more of the United States than I'd ever been in the 10 years of living in the States. Because this orchestra really does go to the most wonderful places. And I absolutely love touring in the States because you discover these communities that are just so passionate about music. And of course, what I absolutely adore about the States is that, all, especially the cultural life in all of these towns and these cities, is that everything that happens there is done by the sheer initiative of the people there. Because there is not a structure in place like in Europe where there is government funding. The support in the States is completely grassroots. And I absolutely love that. And we've come across some of the most magnificent concert halls in where you would never expect to find. And they had just the most extraordinary concert halls that have been built entirely by the local communities. And that, for me, I find incredibly inspiring and feel that, you know, music is in very good hands because it comes from the people. It's a wonderful thing.
Well, you're coming to a marvelous hall in Cedar Falls at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. And you have two amazing works on the docket. Tell us about these works.
We start with the Dvořák, which is the most incredible sextet. It's the most wonderful sextet. And the Dvořák is one of these towering string sextets. I think on one hand you could count sextets that are like that, you know. Dvořák and Brahms are the two that spring to mind. This one is particularly wonderful. You know, Dvořák was always described as the Schubert of the East because he writes the most wonderful melodies and tunes. In fact, I believe the second movement of the Dvořák is this extraordinary dance called a Dumka, which is just a wonderful Eastern European dance, and it has almost a hypnotic and a sadness to it, that a character that is just incredible. And of course, in great composers, every single part is so interesting, and of course, how it all comes together. And I absolutely love playing that piece. That is absolutely a fabulous piece to play. And the second half, I think we're doing the Ionesco, which is a mammoth piece. It's no breaks. It's extraordinary architecture that just takes you on a journey. And I have to also say that I adore this piece because he has thrown everything and the kitchen sink into this composition. And I believe he sort of tinkered with it for a few years after he'd actually wrote it because he was so passionate about this piece. And this piece, it takes you on a journey like no other, from an extraordinary opening where all besides the second cello, which just plays the bass line, and the seven others play in complete unison this extraordinary melody that is relentless, and it sets the stage for what is to come. And then, after that, the first part of it, he writes the most incredible canon between the first violin and the first viola that just goes on and on and on. And playing it, it feels like you're climbing Mount Everest. And personally, my connection to the piece is that I studied with an incredibly famous violinist, Yehudi Menuhin, and his teacher was Enescu. So I feel like I have a connection to that. So I particularly am passionate about this piece.
Tell us about him as a person, because he was a concert violinist, and plus he taught and he wrote music and did all sorts of things.
Enescu is one of these truly rare examples where he had three careers and he was world famous in each of them. He was a world famous violinist, he was a world famous conductor, and he was a world famous composer. So his whole life, he lived and breathed music, and it showed. You know, he was one of these genius, you know, I think probably comparable to, you know, Mozart and all these incredible composers of the past. And I wish that I had had a chance to meet him. I will tell you a little anecdote that Yehudi Menuhin told me. He was having a lesson with Enescu in Paris, and Maurice Ravel burst into and interrupted the lesson, and he had just completed his violin sonata, and he asked very politely if he could quickly read it with Enescu before he took it to the publishers. And Enescu, you know, asked Menuhin if you would he mind to just, you know, take a few minutes out, and Menuhin turned pages. So Ravel sat at the piano, and Enescu sight-read the violin part perfectly. And if you know the Ravel sonata for violin and piano, the last movement is this motu perpetuo. It is just full of black notes. And they read it, and Enescu read it perfectly. I mean, he didn't miss one note. He read the whole sonata fantastically. And Menuhin just could not believe it. And then Ravel said, thank you very much, I shall go. And Enescu said, no, can we play it once more? This is a magnificent piece of music. And so Ravel sat down back at the piano. Enescu shut the music and played the entire thing from memory. And this story was told to me by Menuhin, who was there in the room. And he said, this man, of course, he had a photographic memory. And Menuhin explained, he said he had never experienced anything like that. So this man was truly something quite extraordinary.
The principal first violinist of the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields Chamber Ensemble, Harvey D'Souza. The Academy of St. Martin in the Fields Chamber Ensemble will perform at UNI's Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center on October 5th at 7 p.m. Students 15 and under can use the Gallagher Blue Dorn's Buck a Kid ticket prize for this performance. Between 1 and 2 p.m. on Thursday, October 5th, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields Chamber Ensemble is also presenting masterclasses that are free and open for the public to observe. Those classes will be held at the Great Hall of the Gallagher Blue Dorn. For more details and concert tickets, please see gbpac.com/tickets or call 319-273-SHOW. That's 7469. To hear more from Harvey D'Souza's interview, please check out our iowapublicradio.org homepage. Don't go away. We'll reflect on the many contributions made by one outstanding Iowan. We'll hear how Mr. Wood goes to New York City. And we'll explore the life and times of poet James Hurst, featured this month in the Cedar Falls Authors Festival. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. This year provided some wonderful surprises for the Associate Professor of English in UNI's Department of Languages and Literature, Jim O'Loughlin. And the timing of these discoveries couldn't have been better, as the year-long Cedar Falls Authors Festival was in full swing, honoring well-known writers from the Cedar Valley. One of the authors, James Hurst, is the Cedar Falls Author Festival's featured writer for September. Jim O'Loughlin, who hosts the Final Thursday Reading Series, publishes the Final Thursday Press, and is the author of the fiction collection Dean, 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 shares with us James Hurst's background and the September events hosted by the Cedar Falls Authors Festival.
James Hirst was a farmer poet who was raised in rural Cedar Falls and published over 600 poems during the course of his lifetime in a long career that stretched from the 1920s through the 1980s when he passed away. And he published in a wide range of magazines. I think his first poem was in Ladies' Home Journal. He was in some respected academic publications and some kind of small press publications as well. So he just did such an amazing range of work, and he's a really important figure within Midwestern literature. And he kind of has the moniker, the Robert Frost of the Midwest. And I think that's fair enough. Although Robert Frost said, maybe I'm the James Hirst of the East. So, you know, they were friends as well as colleagues.
And he had a series of things that happened to him during his life.
One of the most significant was that when he was 17, he had a diving accident on the Cedar River and broke his neck and never fully regained full mobility, though for a while he was kind of able to kind of force of will, was able to kind of get himself around, and he would still, even when he couldn't walk, he would still work on the tractor for the family's farm. And over the course of that long recovery, he developed an interest in writing poetry, and that kind of began what was a career that he otherwise probably would not have had. And in fact, it wasn't just that he worked as both a farmer and poet, it's that the experience of farming was absolutely essential to his view of the world and how he understood his work as a poet. I mean, he didn't see these as necessarily opposed things, just different ways of creating meaning.
Tell us about some of the events that this Cedar Falls Author Festival is going to be doing in September then, in tribute to Hirst and his work.
On September 7th, Jeremy Schraffenberger of the North American Review will talk about James Hirst and the North American Review, the nation's longest-running literary magazine, where he was involved during much of the time that he was at UNI. And a week after that, on the 14th, Scott Cowalty, who has recorded music using James Hirst's poems as lyrics, he'll be performing some of those and talking about some new ones that he's done. And that's called James Hirst Poems as Songs. And then I'll be doing something on the next Thursday, on the 21st, be the release of a collection of some newly discovered poems of James Hirst, a collection called Planting Red Geraniums.
And you were very instrumental in this new collection. Tell us how this all evolved.
Yeah, well, this is a surprise to me. So it was just this spring, I'm involved in the project creating a digital archive of James Hirst's work. And I was at the University of Iowa libraries, and because I had seen that they had a collection of some of his papers, and I was hoping to find, and I did find, were some drafts of some of his published poems, which the kind of thing you might not print in a book, but would make a lot of sense to have in an online resource. And I was just matching up the drafts with the published poems, and I had a few I just couldn't figure out. I kept thinking I was searching something wrong. And finally, I realized, took me a while, but I realized the kind of light bulb went off over my head that, oh, wait a second, these are previously unknown poems. And that's notable because there was a collection of poems published after his death in 1993, and then there were more of his unpublished poems that were released as part of the Complete Poetry of James Hirst in 2001. So as far as I know, these poems have not been previously seen, and this will be their first time being released. And it's a really exciting find for someone whose complete work we thought was out there already. And I have to say, seeing some of this work, which was a little more provisional in kind of draft form, I've come to appreciate more about James Hirst's creative process. And a majority of James Hirst's papers are kept at UNI, and that's primarily what I've been working from for this digital archive. I was just kind of seeing if there was some other material out there. You know, it was a file that was established, oh, I think back in 1960, and some materials were added over the years, but I can only imagine that, you know, James Hirst just forgot to tell people about it. And, you know, now that everything's online, I was able to find that. So the materials weren't hidden, it's just that no one knew to look for them.
And tell us then about this new publication that's coming out.
So it's a collection of 23 previously uncollected poems, drawing primarily from this find at the University of Iowa libraries. And it'll be an event. We'll have some other scholars working with me both to read the poems on the 21st, and then we'll kind of discuss them. Now, some of them were poems that he considered for a previous collection, and then there's some others that kind of never got out of this draft folder.
So you were going to read a poem for us today.
This is one of my favorites from the collection. And I will say, some of these poems, the draft ones, you can see why they might not have been published. But there are others that I think are as good as anything else that he's published. And this is one of those poems. It's called Spring Weather. Just when the grass begins to show color, and the first robin is an occasion, and heavy coats and boots sink back in the closets, just when neighbors smile as they meet or lift a hand in greeting, just when the days ahead remind us of lawnmower and garden, it snows. A thick, wet, heavy snow covering everything, including the promise we thought was given. How like my bedfellow who upsets the seasons of our affection and leaves me shivering in my bewilderment at the change in weather. And that's one of the poems, again, from that he never kind of got out of draft form. There's some other poems that he had considered for a collection that he did publish called Man and His Field, and they just didn't make it into the final production. This is one of them. It's called Weatherwise. The wind might be telling a lie about what the season would do. A taste of snow in its mouth might tempt the winter to stay. The balance hung in the sky where tension knotted the clouds. A Phoebe blown from the south lost its voice in surprise. But roots deep in their shrouds broke out new signs each day to show to the literate few how the weather looked to the wise. Then clouds felt sun on their backs. Spring beauties stretched from the leaves and opened their lavender eyes. The buds of the maple relaxed.
That's lovely. All of this, and you can get your hands on this book and you can hear more works read from it. And when is that going to be?
That's going to be on Thursday, September 21st at the Hearst Center for the Arts, where all of these events are taking place, which I should note is the former residence of James Hearst. It's now the city's arts center. Books will be available then, and after that, they'll be for sale at the Hearst Center and then also at University Book and Supply, and it will be available on Amazon.com. There's also going to be a performance of Just Suppose, which is based on the life of Ruth Suckow, and Leanne Nichols will be doing this performance. And there'll be an exhibit at the UNI Museum at the Rod Library about Herb Hague, who was a local writer and cartoonist. And I think that'll be really interesting, is the kind of range of his work in cartooning.
UNI's Associate Professor of English, Jim O'Loughlin, who is also an author, publisher, participant in the Cedar Falls Authors Festival, and the discoverer of those misplaced James Hearst poems. There's a lot happening this fall surrounding literature and the history of Iowa. For additional information on other Cedar Falls Authors Festival events, which will continue into the summer of 2018, be sure to check their website at cfauthorsfestival.org. Just ahead, we'll delve into the talented life and challenges of Grant Wood. And who the heck is Herb Hague? You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
The reason we did this exhibit was we partnered with the Cedar Valley Authors Festival, who right now is focusing on five of the major authors here in town. And we said, you know, this is great. We love all five of these, but what if we threw Herb in for the mix? He's kind of an overshadowed author, and we'd love to feature him. And they have been more than supportive and have been working with us. And it's been a pleasure working with them for this.
Assistant Director and Chief Curator of the UNI Museum, Nathan Arndt. Nathan and the UNI Museum coordinated their Herb Hague and Early Broadcasting on Campus exhibit with the Cedar Falls Authors Festival. Nathan fills us in on the exhibit and Herb Hague's role in shaping the early days of broadcasting in Iowa.
The exhibit is actually called Right Side Up, The Life and Art of Herb Hague, and it opens at the UNI Museum on September 24th at 4 o'clock. And we would love anyone that can be there. It talks about radio history, so you get a chance to see some of the original studio equipment that Herb used. Also looking at early photographs of his studio when it was upstairs in the top of the auditorium building. So a definite shift from the building we're in currently. It's a free event. We encourage you to come down. There'll be opening remarks with people that actually knew Herb and worked with him. So we'll be able to tell you a little bit about him personally. It should be an interesting event. Many things to see, things people haven't seen before, and probably some repeats that people love from their childhood.
He's really kind of a Renaissance man. He has so many interests across so many different areas.
You know, he's bigger than life is the best way I can describe him. I always say the only thing more memorable than his handwriting was his voice. And if you've ever heard him speak, that's very, very true. There's only one Herb Hague. And not only that, but the way he carried himself, the way he worked with the campus university staff, the students, he left a memory with them. Up to this day, people still remember what he did for them. Outside of that, he's a pioneer in the state of Iowa. He broadcasted out to over 3,000 rural schools He did songbooks for them to learn through radio. He was an educating pioneer in some ways, more than what people give him credit for, I think, at times, because education has really changed. And we don't think about these early changes. So we think distance learning now is this new, great, innovative technology. When he set up his studio here doing TV work, he was doing an hour and a half outreach program and boosted attendance at UNI doing that. And this is in the 50s. So he was really an innovator, bigger than life. He was involved in all parts of Cedar Falls as well. So he was on the historical side. He was a curator for the state of Iowa for a few years. And the man only had a minor in history. He was actually a theater and an English professor. So you can see he didn't let anything stop him. Nothing ever limited him. And his artwork was kind of his voice that he went through with this. So you go to his lecture, he'd draw, and it was engaging in a way that most educators at that time point weren't. So it was a different way for people to learn, and I think he really ran with that.
I've had people tell me that he did these really engaging chalk talks. Tell us about those.
So Herb, as a kid, found a passion for drawing, and it was kind of a cartoon design drawing, very neat. And he took this and he incorporated his love of history and he mixed the two. So he'd get up on stage and he'd start telling a story. He was a heck of a storyteller. And as he's telling the story, he'd draw an image. And you have to be careful with him because what he's drawing might not be what he was actually after. So in some cases, he'd start drawing Iowa potatoes or rye or something. And then at the end, he'd make a few extra lines and it became a person, or he'd flip the whole thing upside down and it was a whole new image. So it was engaging. So you're really entranced in the man's story, but then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you get this image that goes along with it. And that's what he was known for. And he would really cater this to the group he was working with. What's really kind of fun is we actually have mailings that he would do. He'd be on the radio show and people would send him names, drawings, and he turned that into a picture of them. So they're little examples of them and they have their addresses and their names and they're interesting. Some of them are made out of footballs because he was a big football fan and wanted to be that. Others were tea kettles or animals and things like that. So that's what he's known for the most. And there's actually a funny story that goes with his radio show. He was giving a talk and he was doing Chief Blackhawk. And it was a little postcard. He goes, "If anyone wants a copy of this, my studio will send out copies to you." Well, the studio got flooded with so many requests, they couldn't keep up. That shows you the popularity across the state of his work. And not only did he go to school during the Depression, but the way he got into radio was that same way. It was kind of a happy accident. In 1941, we had entered the war. And in 1942, you and I was kind of facing this issue of, we don't have the student numbers here. We need the funding. It's not there. So we need to cut staff. And at that time, it was President Price went to the English department and said, "Who do you have that is kind of on that fence?" Well, they had two people. Herb, who was hired in 1938, was only 4 years in, and he was theater design. And then Strayer, after our own Strayer Wood, had been there a long time, respected professor. So they decided to ask Herb, "You can either step down your position or you can take over the radio program." Seems like a no-brainer today. So Herb said, "Of course, I will do that." And one of his quotes says, first day he was actually in his studio, he had one hand on the microphone and one hand on the book on how to do what he was doing because he had never done this before. So throughout his whole life, it was a challenge trying to make things what they were. And even throughout his artwork through the 50s, 60s, he was there for all the major events on campus, all these changing events, and he was sketching it and showing the conflict between the state and the faculty here on campus and kind of the same thing that's going on today. But he was in the middle of it all. So that was his whole life, was in the middle of all of this. But he took it in great stride and he really ran with it and made the best out of it. I think, once again, bigger than life, he wasn't going to let anything get him down.
When he was on the UNI campus, and of course at that time it wasn't called UNI, it was the Iowa State Teachers College, he also was very active in this lecture artist series, and he had this amazing list of people who came here on campus.
And he did audio recordings of all of them, and I don't want to give spoilers because we actually have taken some of those audio files and we've digitized them, and they will be part of the audio landscape of the exhibit. So when you're coming in, you'll hear some of these. And one of my favorite is from 1966 when they redid the Campanile. They had the musician who came in and actually played it for the first time, talking about the history of Campaniles, what they meant to a lot of European society, and why it's important, and then a sampling of his work that he did that day when he played it. So I don't want to give away too much, but he did a whole series of these throughout his entire life, documenting UNI history, state history, local history. If you ever find one, there's a great one about an elephant running up and down the Cedar River, which is just hilarious. It's a great escape from a zoo. But these are all documented, and we're working on getting that collection digitized and sharing to the public. And when you walk in, there's going to be a spot. And during road trips, he liked to be a creative man. He liked to play games. And one was doing sketches out of nothing. So you have a basic shape, and what he turned it into. Sounds a lot like his Chalk Talks. So we're going to invite the public to come down and take their own piece of paper that we provide and do one of these drawings for us. And we're going to put that on exhibit along that front wall. So when you walk in, it's not just going to be Herb's work, but it's going to be the public's as well. And we thought that'd be a nice connection to show people that this is still a relevant form of education and really get them involved. Plus, we like to see what people can do. And it sounds more geared for children, but I'm actually looking forward to trying one myself. So Digital Interactive is doing a ton of those. Like I said, his images had hidden symbols in them. He was very political. And this new one allows you to actually search his paintings in two different medias and actually pull out those images. So if you have a hard time seeing them, we can kind of tell you what they are. I want people to come down and enjoy it, experience it. It is going to take a while to go through because there's a lot of different aspects to it. But I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And hopefully we get a lot of people that can understand and appreciate it.
So what do you want people to know about Herb Haight?
He was multidimensional. And a lot of the exhibits we see of Herb, it's always been about his Chalk Talks, which was a big part of his life. It's true. But there's a lot more to the man. His books that he did, he was very passionate about. His radio program, he loved it. And he went to the point he even sketched his own drawings that he'd mail out to school. So when the kids opened their books, there were these cartoons. And Herb, in his own time, was loved and appreciated. But I think we've kind of lost sight of what he actually set up here on the campus. And overall, for the state of Iowa, he is responsible for educating an entire generation of youth here in Iowa. And bringing that story back to the surface, I think, is important. And working with the Cedar Falls Historical Society in Rosemary Beach, even his books, which were published back in the 70s, still have value. And a lot of people don't know they exist or have never seen them. And it's a great way for young kids to learn about our history. And with Common Core bringing back Iowa history, which is great, these might find a new place in our school systems, which is kind of our goal with this, is to kind of spawn that conversation of him. And just remember who he was. He was passionate. He loved his staff. He did what he could to support. And he was a huge supporter of Iowa. And I think we need to remember that as well. And I will definitely be showing that in the exhibit as we go forward.
Assistant Director and Chief Curator of the UNI Museum, Nathan Arndt. The Right Side Up, The Life and Art of Herb Haight exhibit opens on September 24th at 4 p.m. at UNI's Rod Library. To discover more Herb Haight info and library information times, please check out online museum.library.uni.edu/exhibits. To hear more comments from Nathan Arndt and Rosemary Beach talking about Herb Haight, plus Jim O'Loughlin about finding Hearst's poetry, please see IPR's Iowa Art Showcase website. Don't go away. Grant Wood's American Gothic goes on a road trip. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
The work is so powerful and so strong that I think it's going to be a landmark show for Wood. His work hasn't been seen in New York since 1983, so that this will be the first time several generations of people have been able to look at a large group of his work together. And we're so grateful to all the museums in Iowa that have been generous in sharing their wonderful artwork with us and allowing us to really create an exhibition that presents Grant Wood in a new and fresh way. The Cedar Rapids Museum, for example, the Figge Art Museum, these are both museums that have tremendous holdings. Dubuque Museum, these are museums where Grant Wood is the central figure in the museum's collection. So the willingness of those museums to share work that for their public is the reason they go to the museum is just a sign of their belief in the show and their belief that Grant Wood needs to be understood by a wider audience.
Barbara Haskell, curator at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York City. Barbara is curating a major retrospective of Grant Wood's work at the Whitney next year from March 2nd to June 10th. To make ready for her survey of Grant Wood's work, Barbara came to Iowa to the Grant Wood Symposium in Iowa City and also viewed museum collections of Grant Wood in Cedar Rapids, Dubuque, Des Moines, and Davenport. Barbara and the Whitney asked themselves why Grant Wood's art is so important.
Well, there's sort of several reasons. One, Grant Wood obviously is an artist, you know, is dear to anyone interested in early 20th century American art. And the question of why he's relevant is something that we have been asking ourselves over probably the last couple of decades. And increasingly, he has come to be seen as sort of a paradigmic of a 20th and 21st century state of mind, that on one hand, he certainly represents the whole issue of American identity, the question of who's American, what identity is he mythologizing in his work. And that was the beginning question that we started the exhibition with. And then what became a more interesting question for me is that why is the work so mesmerizing? For a long time, it's been considered sort of a celebrator of the American heartland, quintessential regionalist. And the work is seen as giving order and a sense of strength to American values during the Depression, when Americans were looking for some ground to stand on, as John Dos Passos said. And that's very true about the work. You know, he does represent and kind of epitomize a certain decade, what America was looking for, what Americans need during a time of crisis. But the work is so much more than that. It's retained its power since, you know, the 30s, and there's got to be a reason for that. And that was a question that we really posed as we went into the project. And I think what Grant Wood does is that there's a psychological dimension to the work, which is very unsettling. There's a kind of disconnect between this celebration of the images he's painting, both the landscape and the people of Iowa, and yet a kind of distance and a sense of not quite belonging that makes his work very modern. So that over the decades, there's been the sense of, you know, American Gothic is probably, I think, arguably the most parodied famous work in American 20th century art. And yet it has held our interest, not just because it seems to symbolize, you know, somehow indisputably America, but it also has this ability to tap into something psychologically much deeper. And that's the Grant Wood that sort of emerges, I think, out of our exploration of him in this exhibition.
Barbara Haskell, Whitney Museum curator. In a June 27th interview with the New York Times, Barbara said her perspective on Wood's place in art history had shifted. Barbara shares some of her insight on Grant Wood's background and his works, including American Gothic.
Well, his career is fascinating because up until 1930, he was, you know, sort of a hometown artist supported by the local patrons of Cedar Rapids. And then almost immediately when American Gothic was accepted into the Art Institute of Chicago Annual and then just appeared in newspapers all over the country, he became a superstar overnight. And from 1930 to 1935, he had a wonderful career. That's when he was lecturing around the country. He was heralded in the local papers, but also in New York papers. You know, he was a prophet and reviewed very well. Then in 1935, he had a show in New York. It was the first time anyone in New York had really seen the work in depth. And the critics, for the most part, the leading critics, were very, very harsh on the work. And that, coupled with personal circumstances, his mother was dying, he made a very ill-conceived marriage, short-lived but very disastrous marriage that lasted for 3 years, and his production just plummeted. He did very few paintings after that, very limited paintings. He turned to illustrations of books. He began to work with lithographs in 1937, but he had one series of disappointments after another. The first painting he made after this 1935 show was a work called Spring Turning that the critics just deriled. It was too abstract for them. The accusation that he had been authoritarian when he was head of the PWAP in Iowa, the artists that had worked under him that he thought of as his boys, kind of turned against him when they heard that he was in line to be made head of the WPA from the Midwest. And then, of course, in University of Iowa, Iowa City, where he'd been teaching. When he first arrived on the faculty, he was the superstar and most avant-garde painter. And then when a new chairman came in who was much more sympathetic to modern art, to abstraction, he began to try to marginalize Grant Wood and eventually tried to get him fired by, you know, accusing him of not being able to draw, having to use photographs because he wasn't a good draftsman, of forcing his students to imitate his art, and then accusing him very subtly, obliquely, of being homosexual, which for a regionalist artist in the 30s would have just been the end of his career. So that from 1935 until 1941, he really lived in a state of uncertainty, sort of buffeted by critical attacks, this very bad marriage, accusations from the university. And then once that was resolved, he divorced, he began painting again. His energy imploded. He was just on fire again, began to turn to images of America as a whole. He was very conscious of what was happening in Europe as fascism was gaining greater and greater power. And he began to make pictures that would encourage America to be patriotic about the country. And he started on a new path and made three paintings that really promised a totally new and very profitable direction. And then just suddenly he discovered that he had cancer and died very suddenly.
Which was very tragic.
It was. The trajectory of this just instant fame, and then 5 years of sort of decline. And then just as he was coming out of that decline and was on a new path, filled with this, as he called it, this exploding energy about painting, then he died. It's a fascinating profile.
What about some of these more modernists like Marsden Hartley and Stuart Davis and Milton Avery? And what about the differences between Grant Wood's work and their work?
Well, there was a great hostility between Grant Wood and the modernist, Stuart Davis in particular. So Grant Wood represented everything that those artists were trying to get away from. Grant Wood didn't believe in adopting European abstraction. He thought that the abstractionists had taken art too far and had lost the public. He believed that art really needed to be part of the public. It needed to have a dynamic relationship with a democratic community. And to do that, he believed that it required storytelling. It needed to engage the audience. And the modernists, on the other hand, believed that art needed to progress, that it had to use the styles that seemed more to them appropriate to the 20th century. And so there was a real battle between the regionalists and the realists and the modernists that played out to a great degree in the 1930s. That was the battleground of these two alternative visions about where art should go.
In the exhibit that the museum will be hosting at the Whitney, you have right around 130 works. Tell us about some of the works that will be there.
Well, there'll be all the paintings that people know, paintings like American Gothic, of course, Daughters of the Revolution, Spring Turning, Victorian Survival, Parson Weems' Fable. But then there'll be other pieces that people don't know. We're really going to take a look at Grant Wood's mural work and bring that into an exhibition context, really for the first time, showing this mural work from Ames that people, if they know it all, they know it in just fragments from books. We're bringing in his book illustrations, so not only the full sweep of, for example, the Main Street drawings that he did for the Sinclair Lewis book, but also other book covers. He did quite a number of book covers. And, of course, we'll deal with the lithographs that are very famous, Spring in the Country, Spring in Town, some of the great pieces that people think of when they hear the name Grant Wood, but also the decorative arts, these beautiful silver pieces that he made when he was working as a decorative artist, and then the Impressionist paintings. There's a wonderful corncob chandelier, for example, that I'm predicting is going to be one of the stars of the show, this chandelier made out of bronze, but made out of multiple stalks of corn. He was a wonderful draftsman, so we'll have drawings, study drawings for paintings to show his working method. He was methodical. And one of the aspects of his work that we've discovered is that this sort of American strain, that he believed that Americans were more factually oriented, that there was something about facts and concrete reality that was very American. And it was one of the perceptions that led him to make the kind of work that he made, this kind of hard edge, precise style, that he felt was somehow American, that it conveyed something American to him. And there's a long history of that hard-edged style being identified with American painters, from John Singleton Copley to Charles Sheeler. And it also then tied in with these early childhood experiences that he had of his father, who he recalled, you know, one time making him give back a Grimm's fairy tale book to a neighbor that had lent the book to the young Grant Wood, saying that we Quakers read only real things. So this kind of connection between this American vision and his childhood experiences led to this work that was, on one hand, very realistic. It's almost photographic on one hand, and yet it has, on the other hand, this sense of kind of a magic unreality to it. So the tension between those two things, I think, is one of the aspects that just hold your interest. You know, viewers project into the work what their own experiences are. So in his portraits, for example, he adopted the early Renaissance technique of including objects in their portraits that would say something about the sitter beyond just physical likeness. So Grant Wood includes objects in portraits, but in his case, their meaning is so ambiguous that they really lead to every viewer reading into them exactly what he or she has experienced in life. So, for example, Victorian Survival, the portrait of the Victorian woman with a very long neck, and to her right, there's sort of an elusive image of a telephone. And people have read that telephone in multiple ways. But that's the power of the picture, that it engages each individual viewer according to each viewer's own experiences and predilections.
What do you want viewers who come to your exhibit at the Whitney Museum, what do you want to have them come away with?
I think what we want with the exhibition is to dispel the idea that Grant Wood is simply a regionalist artist, that he was important in a particular decade of the 20th century, but the work doesn't have relevance to today. I want people to come to the show and see work that they understand relates to something about modern day experience that compels them, and that the mesmerizing quality of Grant Wood's work is its modernity. That it's both a record of a certain moment in time when Americans wanted stability and order and a sense of, you know, pictures of prosperity and strength. It's that, but that it also is something that really relates very much to what the modern condition of living in the world is. And in that sense, he's a realist. And I think that his contemporary is more Edward Hopper than any other artist, that they both tap into psychological aspects of their own lives, presenting kind of portraits of who they are that everyone can relate to, that really codifies or embodies something about modern day experience.
Barbara Haskell, curator of the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York City. Barbara is the curator of a major retrospective of Grant Wood's work showing at the Whitney from March 2nd through June 10th of next year. The exhibition is called Grant Wood, American Gothic and Other Fables. To hear more from Barbara about Grant Wood, please see IPR's Iowa Art Showcase page from the iowapublicradio.org website. Barbara Haskell will be a special guest at this year's Des Moines Art Center Gala being held on September 16th. Two of the works in the Whitney's Grant Wood exhibit are works from the Des Moines Art Center's permanent collections. Barbara will also present an illustrated lecture tracing Grant Wood's life and career on Sunday afternoon, September 17th at the Des Moines Arts Center. Admission for the lecture is free, but reservations are required. For more details and gala and lecture tickets, please see the Des Moines Arts Center's website at desmoinesartscenter.org. The Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Ken Schenkel, Sean Page, Edouard Duval Carrier, Harvey D'Souza, Jim O'Loughlin, Nathan Arndt, and Barbara Haskell. Production thanks goes to IPR's Tony Daner, Chris Fenton, and Paul Roost with Argo Studios in New York City. Program research was provided by Rachel Berenger. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.